I think you all heard me say that it's nice to be here. This talk is largely based on a paper that is on archive, and what's not on archive should be on archive soon. Hopefully I'm not dooming myself. This talk is going to be a very, 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 very simple-minded talk, wherein we're going to attack some extremely, almost embarrassingly, simple questions about non-relativistic physics. As a result, this talk is supposed to be primarily pedagogical in nature, so if there's any point that's unclear, please stop and ask. In principle, we should all be able to understand everything that I say by the end of the hour. So let me start with three extremely basic questions about non-relativistic physics. In theories that enjoy, that are not Lorentz invariant, but have a Galilean boost symmetry, there's always something called a particle number symmetry. It's a global symmetry that the theory got to have in order to exist. And there's, in these theories, there's also a momentum current, and there's a folklore theorem that you'll find instances of it, for instance, in Landau and elsewhere, that these two currents are always proportional to each other, up to a pure number that, well, these theories are characterized by some mass, and there's a charge, and well, there's a mass-to-charge ratio that is constant for all particles in the theory. And the statement is that momentum got to be equal to particle number. This is the folklore theorem. And it's the folklore theorem in the sense that every theory that people write down that enjoys Galilean symmetry, that identity holds. Here's a very basic question. Does it always hold as a consequence of the symmetries of the problem? That is that identity a word identity? It's one incredibly basic question. Another question that one could ask, for those of us used to relativistic field theory, we're used to wonderful things called anomalies, whether it be conformal anomalies or chiral anomalies, gravitational anomalies, what have you. Are there non-relativistic versions of these things? One very important reason why you would ask this is in the context of topologically non-trivial phases of matter, which enjoy some gapless quantum field theory that live on their boundary. When you can describe these things, when you can realize these things in relativistic field theory, it's often the case that this gapless quantum field theory that lives on the edge of some gapped bulk state is protected to be gapless by virtue of an anomaly. What typically happens is that there's some Atuft anomaly, like a parity anomaly or a U1 anomaly, that lives on the boundary that's canceled by inflow from the bulk. That protects the gaplessness of the phase. One could ask, though, and in the case where condensed matter people actually care about these things, are there Atuft anomalies? What are their structure? What do they look like? Another question one could ask is if there's interrelations between correlation functions, between different observables that are mandated purely by the symmetries of the problem. That would be true in an arbitrarily strongly correlated CFT, or you know, non-CFT, what have you. So these are some like really, really basic questions. And in order to, oh, and actually forgot about this slide. Let me point out that there's already an extensive body of literature on this third point. In particular, in the context of the fractional quantum Hall effect, there are claims that there are a number of interrelations between transport that arise from gravitational Chern-Simons terms in the low energy effective action of a fractional quantum Hall state. However, in the absence of Lorentz invariance, one should ask, what do you mean exactly by a gravitational Chern-Simons term? How are these things defined? What's the spin connection? Things like that. These are basic questions, and I'd like to start attacking them during this talk today. And I claim that all of them can in principle be answered once we know how to put non-relativistic theories on a non-trivial manifold. I mean, especially in the case of anomalies, this is kind of clear. In order to classify or even to compute the potential anomalies of a quantum field theory, you got to know the background fields that you can couple it to first. And what are the symmetries of the problem? So how are we going to go about doing this? This is essentially what we're going to do today. In order to proceed, I'm going to divide up the space of non-relativistic field theories into two big categories, those that enjoy a Galilean boost symmetry and those that do not. In principle, the answer to this question, how to put these theories on a non-trivial spacetime, should have been recorded in textbooks decades ago, but it was not. It's been something that's only been attacked quite recently. For theories without a boost invariance, there is some very, very recent work, as in papers that appeared on Archive in July of this year, that I think have more or less solved this problem. However, for theories with the boost symmetry, it's a little bit trickier. And for that, there was not a completely satisfactory description of how to put these things on a non-trivial spacetime. And that's the one that we're going to attack today. I should say, and the reason, I'll get to the reason why this is a little bit non-trivial. It's worth noting that there is something that Son has progressively developed ever since a paper with Wingate in 2005 that's sort of a precursor to telling you how to put these things on a non-trivial manifold. And this sometimes goes by a non-relativistic general covariance. You'll see it in his papers often. Was one of the things that inspired this work, actually. It should be noted that what Son did is absolutely fantastic. It's realized holographically, amongst other things. However, it does depend on some explicit choice of coordinates. We're going to try to get past that today. Particularly, we want to understand what role the boost symmetry plays. The thing that makes this at once both interesting and a little bit non-trivial, but not terribly non-trivial, is the following beautiful fact. As I mentioned, all Galilean theories have a conserved quantity particle number. And that particle number symmetry, so there's a generator of that guy, a conserved charge, let me call it M. It commutes with everything, so it's a conserved charge. However, it's central in the Galilean algebra. It appears on the right-hand side of the commutator of momenta and Galilean boosts. So it's a conserved quantity which is intimately tied up with the space-time symmetries. And in particular, if you were to start coupling this theory to various background fields, if you coupled the number current to a background gauge field, this almost automatically tells you that the corresponding gauge field is not an ordinary U1 connection. It's something a little bit different. We'll see how this works shortly. I also have some, I should just get this out there, I have some completely idiosyncratic motivation for studying this problem as well, that maybe is not shared by anyone in the room, but I'll tell you about it anyway. Over the last 10 years, as sort of an indirect consequence of ADS-CFT and holography, we've learned a ton of things about relativistic field theory at non-zero temperature that we should have known decades ago, but it was only by studying the dynamics of slowly varying black holes that we figured them out. And by we, I mean many illustrious people. You know their names. So I mentioned three things that we've learned right here, one of which is just to put the theory of relativistic fluid mechanics on a solid footing, almost as solid as Wilsonian effective field theory. So that, in the sense of having a gradient expansion and understanding where certain a priori, there are certain conditions that are imposed within hydrodynamics that seem to come out of nowhere and tell you how to construct the theory, and you can really understand those from solid field theoretic principles now. There's also, to highlight something else, a Tuft anomalies make a surprising modification to transport. There's all sorts of wonderful things that we've learned about relativistic fluid mechanics. However, almost none of those things are understood for non-relativistic fluid mechanics, which has been around for a long time, coming up on its 200th anniversary before too long. And for my part, I would like to see non-relativistic hydrodynamics brought up to the same level of sophistication as relativistic hydro. I mean, something to give a sense for how bad the situation is for non-relativistic hydro. These are effective theories that have some collective degrees of freedom. They have some classical fields. And it's understood in relativistic hydro, albeit only recently, how physics is invariant under field redefinitions. as simple of a thing as that is. The corresponding statement is not known for non-relativistic hydro. How non-relativistic hydro physics is invariant under field redefinitions. So it'd be nice to see that brought up to speed. And there are, of course, lots of like very practical reasons why you would do this that non-high energy theorists would care about. In particular, once you successfully treat non-relativistic hydro, you get access to correlation functions in the hydrodynamic limit. That's something that's very practical and very useful. You can characterize Hall transport and lots of other things this way and find interrelations between Hall and thermal and blah, blah, blah transport. Okay, enough for motivation. Let's do this. So my plan for the rest of the talk is the following. I'm going to answer this question, how to couple these theories to space-time. We're going to do it pedagogically by just looking at free field theory and then seeing the sort of elements that we need to introduce to make the thing covariant under coordinate reparametrizations and so on. We'll check it to make sure, give it some sanity checks because we're physicists. And then I'll talk, I probably won't have time to talk about hydro, but I would like to spend the last third of the talk talking about a surprising connection to things that are called warped conformal field theories in two dimensions. If you don't know what that is, that's okay, you'll find out soon. So without any further ado, this is the Galilean version of a free scalar field theory of d phi squared. This is a Lagrangian. It has, this is, if you will, a kinetic term for a field psi, a complex field psi. In non-relativistic physics, there's no spin statistics theorem. So psi can be either a scalar or a fermion, doesn't matter. And this term right here, this is shorthand for psi dagger d psi minus d psi dagger psi. If you vary this thing with respect to psi dagger to compute the classical equation of motion for psi, you'll get the Schrodinger equation. That's gets you back to something that you know. And you can also check that this theory is invariant not only under the Galilean symmetries, but under something that's called the Schrodinger symmetry group. Let me just tell you what that is at the algebraic level. But the fact that this is Schrodinger rather than Galilean means that you can think of this as a Galilean conformal field theory. The symmetries of the problem, the things that generate the Schrodinger group, are the generators of Galilean, which are these guys. You have space-time translation invariants generated by the H's and P's. Theory is rotationally invariant generated by the R's. It enjoys a Galilean boost symmetry, K's. And there's a particle number symmetry, M, under which psi just rotates in the way that you would expect. In addition, the theory has a dilatation symmetry. So there's a generator of scale translations. And in this case, in non-relativistic physics, if you don't have the Lorentz symmetry and you have scale invariance, there's no symmetry principle that tells you how time has to scale relative to space. So the relative scaling is actually a critical exponent. It's often called z. And if you have z equals 2, which you can kind of see you do here, you have one time derivative and two space derivatives, then the symmetry group actually enhances. And you get a special conformal generator as well. It's often called C. You can think of that thing as doing a space-time inversion, a time translation, and then a space-time inversion again. It's just worth noting, you can have scale invariant non-relativistic theories without Z equals 2, without having the Schrodinger symmetries. But if you have Z equals 2, then you have the Schrodinger. Anyway, so that's our simplest thing. That's going to be our baby example that we're going to play with for the next few slides. And because there's a lot of symmetries, by the Noether procedure, there's lots of symmetry currents. There's an energy current that's conjugate to time translation. It looks like that. It's conserved on shell. There is a number current. It takes that form. I've normalized things here so that the charge of psi under the symmetry is m. So Q equals M here. It's just worth noting, by the way, if you might remember all the way back to undergraduate quantum mechanics, in the Schrodinger equation, there's a probability current. That's this. That's the number current in field theory terms. You can kind of see that. Psi dagger psi, you would just call the density, the probability density. And there's also, okay. And then there's also a momentum and a spatial stress tensor that generates spatial translations. There's also a word identity on shell. And my statement earlier about a folklore theorem, you see it right here, in that the momentum current and the particle number current are exactly equal to each other. Here I've set q equals m, so m by q is 1, and it all works. There's an example of what I was talking about. So that's the theory. Those are some symmetries. And now we want to couple it to space-time. And as high-energy theorists, it's pretty darn obvious what you got to do. So first thing first, anywhere you see a partial derivative, it got to be replaced with a covariant derivative. We're going to couple the theory to a gauge field that talks to particle number. So here's my covariant derivative that acts on psi. Here, let me just think of space-time scalars, so I don't have to worry about subtleties with coupling to a spin connection. We can deal with that a little later. What else do we need to do? On the partial zero, I got to replace that with a vector that dots into a covariant derivative. Let me call that vector v mu. For the spatial metric here, I got to replace that with delta ij. I got to replace it with like a spatial inverse metric. Let me call it h upper index mu nu. I'm going to require that v mu, my only condition on v and h that I'm going to require from here on out is that I can form a tensor v mu, v nu plus h mu nu. I require that that thing's invertible, that it's rank d. So h mu nu is rank d minus 1, but that tensor would be rank d, which it is in this case. And then the only other thing I got to do is to write down a covariant version of d dx, a covariant integration measure. So we're almost all the way there. Let me just talk for a moment about the measure. So I'm just going to call the measure root gamma. Let me tell you what it is. So, as I mentioned, I can form a tensor gamma upper index mu nu, just v mu, v nu plus h. That thing's invertible, so let me invert it. Can decompose it in this way, where n and h satisfy various projection conditions. N dot v is 1, n dot h is 0, etc. And then the root gamma here is nothing more than the square root of the determinant of that tensor. Very similar to root g. If you will, you can think about this as being, I can construct a Euclidean metric on the spacetime using v and h. And that's just root g built out of that metric. All right, that's great. What we've done, we've taken our very, very basic theory. And we've made it, we've done the obvious thing. We've made it manifestly reparametrization invariant and also manifestly invariant under U1 gauge transformations. That's wonderful. One could ask, though, what is there some way of manifesting the Galilean boost symmetry here? That's right. But if I do things properly, I can take non-relativistic limits of relativistic systems. What I'd like to do, though, is to have a purely non-relativistic construction. Typically, when we take non-relativistic limits of relativistic field theories, we're essentially accessing some subspace of non-relativistic field theories that can be accessed by taking directly like large C limits of perturbative QFTs, perturbative relativistic QFTs. I think that's just a subspace. I don't see any reason why, you know, if I, that some RG flow, say to some strongly interacting or just even order one interacting theory, would commute with the non-relativistic limit. So what I have in mind, I want to have a purely non-relativistic construction so that I have the technology to deal with things that arise from taking non-relativistic limits, say, of strongly interacting field theories, for which I don't know how to take the large C limit. But it's a good question. Any other questions before we move on? Okay, good. So the thing that's left is what, where the Galilean symmetry is hiding here. And if you stare at this action long enough, what you'll notice after a while is that there's a shift symmetry in the game. In particular, if you shift V upper index by a spatial vector here means H dotted into some psi, so that thing dotted into N is 0. So if you shift V and simultaneously you shift A mu in this way, where P is like a spatial projector, H lower index dotted into H upper index, the action is invariant, exactly invariant, not even invariant up to a boundary term. It's just on the nose invariant. That's important. So we're good. So my claim is that this symmetry in general, I should always impose it if I want to construct a Galilean field theory and also to couple it to spacetime. All right, so now we can make a proposal, which we can then test here shortly. If we want to take a general Galilean field theory and couple it to spacetime and maintain all these symmetries, the background I ought to couple it to is the one I mentioned there, V, H, and A. Or equivalently, using V and H, I can construct an N and an H lower index. So that's the spacetime background. And then I ought to impose the following symmetries. I ought to impose invariance under coordinate reparameterizations, U1 gauge transformations, and this shift symmetry, which for weird historical reasons has a name, and it's called invariance under Milne boosts. Okay. We can even make contact. I showed you before there's all these Noetherian currents. We can actually make contact with those very easily using this. You can tell my generation of physicist, actually, because I tend to prefer to think of symmetry currents and energy momentum tensor, et cetera, not in terms of a Noetherian calculus, but instead in terms of variations of a partition function with respect to some background fields. So I'd like to have a way of doing that here, and then I can relate it in flat space back to the Noetherian procedure. So, well, let me just walk you through very, very briefly how this works. In order to make contact with what I wrote before, you gotta make an overcomplete basis for the background fields. So I imagine that my spacetime background is V, H, and A, and N, under the constraint that n dot v is 1 and n dot h is 0. And then I define all my currents through functional variations of a partition function. So particle number current's going to be conjugate to a mu. I let the variations of n be unconstrained, be arbitrary, the energy current's conjugate to that. And letting the variations of n be constrained means that some of the variations of v mu and h mu nu are fixed, such that n dot h is always 0, for instance. And the unconstrained part of those variations, the conjugate operators, I call the momentum and spatial stress tensor. And you can check in this free field theory example that if you compute all those currents and you compute all those currents by variation and you put them in flat space, then you get the same ones I wrote before from the Noetherian. So this is already a good sign. You can also use that, how to say, that if we maintain all these symmetries, then the partition functions, say, invariant under coordinate reparameterizations, and you can use those statements to derive word identities that are very useful. In particular, and this is fantastic, the word identity for the Milne symmetry is exactly this folklore theorem that I talked about at the very beginning. And you can kind of see this very, very quickly. So the way this Milne symmetry acts, it shifts V. And it also, at least at the infinitesimal level, it just shifts A by the same transverse one form. So if you look at the variation of W under the boost, you just get psi transfer, like a spatial psi dotted into J minus spatial psi dotted into momentum. That thing got to be 0. And that will tell you that momentum and particle number are equal. that's already very nice. We proved a folklore theorem. One could ask, what kind of picture should we draw for this geometry that we're coupling to, since it's not ordinary Riemannian geometry? There's this N and there's this H. It turns out that if you go into the literature, the sort of geometry that we've constructed here is a version of something that goes by the name of Newton-Cartan geometry. Some weird esoteric corner of the literature, which you can verify for yourself if you go digging into it with any enthusiasm. But if you think about it long enough and you try to draw a picture to summarize it, you'd probably end up drawing this picture right here. So the picture you would draw for this geometry is the following. There are spatial slices depicted here. And there are sort of natural trajectories that tell you how you go from a point on one spatial slice to a point on the next spatial slice, and you're transported there along the integral curves of V mu. So there's spatial slices, H effectively defines a metric on those spatial slices, and V tells you how to go, roughly speaking, from one slice to the next. But there's some redundancy in how you do this. It's reflected in this shift under which you can schlep V around. So the delta T part of V is always the same, but you have some freedom which spatial point you connect in from one slice to the next. To call this thing geometry, we have almost all the right steps to call this honest geometry. There's just one thing that's really left, and that's the following. Let me just go back to relativistic field theory and Riemannian geometry so this makes sense. If you were coupling a relativistic field theory to geometry, you'd say, oh, you couple it to some background metric, and then you use that metric so that you can take derivatives in a way that's invariant under coordinate reparametrizations. And if you want to do that just using the metric, it turns out that that's unique. There's only one connection that you can define that does that, and it's the Levi-Civita connection, under which the metric is covariantly constant. What we want to do here is, to treat this properly, is to form the analog of the Levi-Civita connection, so that we can take covariant derivatives just using the background fields I've defined, N, H, and A. Turns out that this is a little bit more non-trivial than in the relativistic case, in the Riemannian case. As opposed to, one has to essentially fix a number of conditions in order to make the covariant derivative unique. And I listed them there. One can uniquely fix the covariant derivative, analogous to the uniqueness of the Levi-Civita connection, by demanding that this data, N and H, upper index, is covariantly constant. Turns out that if you do that and you have dN, like the exterior derivative of N non-zero, then you can't simultaneously maintain the covariant constancy of N and the absence of torsion. So what one can do is the next best thing. You can demand that there's zero spatial torsion, meaning H lower index dotted into the spatial torsion, into the torsion tensor is zero. So one can demand that. And then also the derivative of the velocity vector, if you dot n into the index of v, you get zero by the constancy of n and the fact that n dot v is one. So the only non-vanishing part of the derivative you can get by dotting h lower index into that guy, that's a two-index object. The anisymmetric part of it is completely free. So something you can do, if you wanted, is just to fix it to be zero. Something else you can do is to fix it to be F mu nu, the field strength of A mu. In any event, the end result that you get after all these gymnastics is this connection right here. Let me just point out the only place where the F appears is here in this last bit. There's a few observations in order before going on. The first is that this last term is just a tensorial redefinition of the connection, so you could get rid of it if you wanted to. Not terribly important. This thing is nice insofar as if n is closed, if dn is 0, then this connection, well, it's manifestly invariant under U1, but it's also invariant under these Milne boosts. However, if N is not closed, then it turns out there's no connection that you can define out of this data, which is invariant under U1 and boosts. It's kind of annoying. As a matter of practice, it means that if you want to form tensorial invariants that are in, like, they're good tensors under coordinate reparametrizations, but they're invariant under the other symmetries, it's very hard to do it because your covariant derivative is not manifestly invariant. So even if you took the derivative of a Milne invariant object, a Milne engage invariant tensor, the covariant derivative would not be Milne engage invariant. Anyway, that's c'est la vie, that's life. That's the geometry. Let's check it to make sure that we're not crazy, or that I'm not crazy, rather. So the first thing that we can do is in analogy with relativistic field theory. If you look at relativistic field theory and you couple it to a non-trivial spacetime and you couple it to a metric, impose invariance under reparametrizations, then you put it in flat space, you can recover the fact that the theory is that the global symmetries of that theory are the generate the Poincaré group by looking at the coordinate reparametrizations which fix the flat metric, fix the metric that you couple to. What are the isometries? In the same way, here, we should be able to recover the Galilean group in flat space by looking at the symmetries which fix, like, the flat structure. So by flat structure here, I'm going to mean that V is just along partial zero, that the spatial metric is just delta ij, and that A mu is zero. And if I compute the global symmetries, that is the reparametrizations, Milne boost, and U1 gauge that fix that guy, I got to get the Galilean group back. And of course, I wouldn't be telling you that unless it did work, and it does. You get the whole Galilean algebra by doing this. And it's actually kind of cute the way that it works. In order to get this to do this properly, what you find is that the Galilean boost symmetry, it's actually a combination of a coordinate reparametrization, a boost, and a gauge transformation. It's a combination of all three, and as a result, when you compute the algebra, the commutator of the boost with the momentum, they actually commute up to a pure gauge rotation, a constant gauge rotation. And that is exactly the generator of particle number here. So it all works out beautifully. You can do something else. You can look at scale invariant theories. So an analogy with relativistic field theories, conformal field theories, where we, if we imagine coupling them to spacetime, we try to do it in a vial invariant way. If I have a non-relativistic theory, I can couple it to background, and I claim in a way that where one should impose a sort of vial symmetry, under which V, H, and generically A as well scale with some critical exponent, Z, where z equals 2 corresponds to Schrodinger. And you can compute the global symmetries that you get from this in flat space. And again, if you have z equals 2, you get exactly the Schrodinger group. And if you don't, then you get everything else but the special conformal. So that also works. Something else that works is we can connect back to what Son did previously. I told you before that Son has developed some non-relativistic version of covariance that depends on some choice of coordinates, but tells you the right background fields that you should couple to and some symmetries that you ought to impose. And let me emphasize that this thing was very reasonable. You could show that free field theories, many interacting theories were invariant under those symmetries, but also that those symmetries act nicely on the boundary of asymptotically Schrodinger spacetimes, and therefore are realized for the holographic duals of for many string theories. So we can connect to that here in the following way. One can gauge fix the Milne symmetry entirely by demand, at least locally anyway, by demanding that V mu is just along partial zero. One can fix that. If you do that then, and you do a general coordinate reparametrization, then you'll screw up this gauge fixing condition, and you got to do a compensating Milne boost to preserve it. As a result, the reparametrizations are constrained, and if you look at the variation of the various fields under those constrained transformations, you get exactly Sonne's transformations on the nose. That is, Sonne's non-relativistic covariance is exactly this thing I'm mentioning upon gauge fixing this Milne symmetry. Something else that works, speaking of asymptotically Schrodinger spacetimes, if you wanted to embed all this non-relativistic geometry nicely into Riemannian geometry, here's how you would do it. You can get all of this structure from a d plus one dimensional Lorentzian manifold with a null isometry. So let me just pick coordinates in such a way that the null isometry is just along partial minus, along x minus. And then I can write down the most general d plus one dimensional metric that is invariant under that, which means I can write it like this in some sort of light cone gauge, where all of the component fields, n mu, a, and h lower index, depend on the x mu, but not on x minus. And notice that there's no dx minus squared term, so that n is really null. So there you see some Newton-Cartan data. You see the n, a, and h. That is to say, this Lorentzian construction automatically hands you a Newton-Cartan structure with all the lower index data. Why do I mention this? I mention this because if you look at the holography of asymptotically Schrodinger spacetimes, and you look at the boundary asymptotics for those guys, this is what you would identify as the metric on the boundary of those spacetimes. So that is, the asymptotic near boundary metric for these guys takes this kind of form. So n squared divided by r to the 2z, and then a metric like this, plus dr squared by r squared, where d minus is a null isometry. That is to say that this whole construction, this Newton-Cartan structure, this is the thing that holographic Schrodinger theories naturally couple to, and they're automatically invariant under all these symmetries that I've mentioned. They act nicely on the gravity dual when it exists. Well, more precisely, you get the reparametrization in U1. A mu here is the graviphoton of the null reduction. One could ask about the Milne boost. They're the only thing that's missing here. It turns out that if you stare at this metric long enough, you'll realize there's actually an ambiguity in how you extract, how you define n, a, and h out of it. And in fact, if you performed a Milne boost on a and h, it's a great, like, 1 minute computation pen and paper. You get exactly the same higher dimensional metric back again. So the Milne boosts are already there in the d plus one dimensional construction. There's just some ambiguity in how you extract the non-relativistic background. It's also just worth noting, because I babbled so much about all the different connections in the game, that if you compute the Levi-Civita connection for this guy with all mu nu rho indices, no minus indices, then you don't get quite the connection that I mentioned before, but you get something that's related to it by a tensorial redefinition. In particular, you get the connection that's Milne invariant, but not U1 invariant. It's also torsionless. So n is not constant. And it's not that surprising, actually, that it's not U1 invariant, because here, like, the A is the graviphoton of a reduction. So gauge transformations of A correspond to reparametrizations of x minus. And the connection has a tensorial redefinition under reparametrizations of x minus. So that's how you can understand this. All right. Let me also say, for Maxime, that you can understand all this geometry but from large C limits of relativistic field theories, at least perturbative relativistic field theories. I won't comment on this any more than what I'm about to say, just for lack of time, but the basic idea is take your favorite relativistic field theory with a mass gap and some flavor symmetry, and then turn on a chemical potential that's very, very close to mc squared for m, the lightest charge state, and then send c to infinity. antiparticles will decouple, you'll end up with some non-relativistic field theory, you'll enjoy a Galilean boost symmetry, and if you do that covariantly, so you don't have to just take a chemical potential, you could take an A mu that's along any direction, mc squared, then you'll get this geometry back and all these symmetries of this problem. Okay, so made a proposal, checked it. In the 20 minutes that remain, I want to tell you something that I think is really cool that just learned since over the last couple weeks about a connection with warped conformal field theories. To tell you about that connection, I first have to tell you what a warped conformal field theory is. This is also only very recent. The story I'm about to tell you is due to Diego Hoffman and Andy Strominger. They wrote a beautiful paper in, I think, early fall of 2011 on this. And what they considered was the following. I'll tell you the motivation for it in a moment. Suppose that you have a two-dimensional field theory, not Lorentz invariant, that's invariant under translations. I'm going to notate the coordinates here as x plus and minus because they do. Not necessarily because there's an underlying light cone structure. Just calling the coordinates that. So there's space-time translation invariance. And let me also suppose that there is a scaling symmetry under which just x minus scales, but not x plus. It's worth noting that 2D CFTs comprise a subset of these kinds of theories. 2D CFTs, ordinary 2D CFTs, would have an extra symmetry under which x plus scales, rescales by some scale factor, a different scale factor than this one. You just think of x plus and x minus there as light cone coordinates. Well, if you use basic things about field theory that we love, unitarity, locality, a discrete bounded below spectrum for the dilatation operator, then it turns out that all those things enhance these symmetries to affine Lie algebras. Much like an ordinary 2D CFT. There's a whole zoo of cases that you can get out of this, but there's two sort of minimal ones, one of which is familiar, namely, you can end up having an extra scaling symmetry under which x plus rescales, and then you get back ordinary two-dimensional conformal field theory, our friend. There's another kind of weird and exotic possibility. What happens there is that right-moving translations get enhanced to a whole Virasoro, characterized by some central charge, and that left-moving translations get enhanced to a right-moving Katz-Moody. So all the operators here are right-moving in this second case, and so you can think of this thing as a sort of chiral CFT without Lorentz invariance. I say it that way because Let me make a brief excursion. In quantum Hall systems, these are gapped quantum field theories, non-relativistic quantum field theories, where the boundary states are some sort of chiral CFT. But there's no underlying Lorentz invariance. And as far as I can tell from talking with condensed matter people, the general expectation, based on lots of computation and certain soluble examples, is that that thing has some emergent Lorentz invariance. And then it's really a chiral CFT in the way that we would say it is. But as far as I can tell, the symmetries of the problem don't prevent you from realizing quantum Hall states, strongly correlated quantum Hall states, where the boundary theory is actually of this type, of a warp CFT, rather than an ordinary chiral CFT. I'd love to pursue that further. Anyway, this is what these authors mean when they talk about a warped conformal field theory. It's the second case. Why did they, and in a slide, this is what I mean by, so the symmetries of the problem end up getting enhanced in this way. You can end up having any reparametrization of x minus, any right-moving reparametrization of x minus, and you can have any additive right-moving reparametrization of x plus. And so there's a stress tensor of a sort, characterized by some central charge, C. And also, the left-moving momentum ends up looking like a right-moving current algebra with level K. So why did these people do this? The reason why they did it is because in a wide family of near-horizon black hole geometries, there's some sort of warped ADS3 factor. Warped meaning that the isometries there are SL2R across U1, and it looks like an ADS2 that's non-trivially fibered over some U1, over some circle direction. And depending very carefully on how you define the boundary conditions for gravity in those kinds of spacetimes, you can actually get exactly these symmetries. A right-moving Virasoro, right-moving Katz-Moody. So that's sort of their motivation. It should be said that one really nice thing that comes out of this analysis, this was based on a paper of Stefan de Tournay, Tom Hartman, and Diego Hoffman, is that using these symmetries, you can derive some invariance properties of the torus partition function, the thermal partition function for these theories, and you can derive a sort of Cardy formula, which counts the asymptotic density of states at high energy. And that thing exactly matches the entropy for these black holes. So in that sense, if these gravity in these near horizon domains is really dual to some warp conformal field theory, that would give you a microscopic matching for the black hole entropy. However, this whole field was kind of bad because there were no actual explicit examples of warp CFTs that you could point to and look at and study. No even free field Lagrangians. The only thing that people had were these near horizon black holes, and as I tried to indicate, there's some fun debate that's consumed, I think, most of the literature on this subject back and forth between more or less the same group of people, which boundary conditions you should impose and what kind of symmetries do you get as a result. However, this last point, this bad point, that's not last Tuesday. That's two Tuesdays ago, actually. This last problem was solved in a very nice paper by Diego Hoffman and his collaborator, Blaise Rollier. The way they solved this problem, it's going to come back to everything else I told you very shortly. You'll see how. They coupled these things to geometry, to some background spacetime. And they ended up proposing something that you should couple to. It's some variant of Newton-Cartan geometry that they dub warp geometry. And once you know the various background fields and everything else, they can write down invariant actions more easily. It helps to know how to contract indices, basically. So their example, their simplest example that they write down is essentially that of a Weyl fermion with a mass term. You would say, you shouldn't write down mass terms for Weyl fermions because they break Lorentz invariants. Here, that's not such a bad thing. They want to break Lorentz invariants. So that's their example, or that's one of their examples. They also consider some BC and a beta gamma system, I think, if I remember correctly. However, we can understand all of this in light of everything that I told you earlier in the talk. They come very close to saying this in their paper, but they don't. But what you can say after thinking about the problem for a little bit is that warp conformal field theories are actually Galilean CFTs. And rather than start with what they did and derive this fact, it's actually easier to go the other way, to consider a Galilean CFT and then a certain type of Galilean CFT and then recover all these symmetries. Let's suppose that, if it's possible, that one considers a theory of completely neutral Galilean fields, massless Galilean fields. I mean, M equals zero in the sense that they are neutral under particle number. So for all intents and purposes, there is no particle number here. P and K commute, or if you will, as an operator equation, M equals zero. In which case, I don't couple anymore to a background gauge field, I just couple to the spacetime data, N and H. If I'm in two dimensions, H is a rank one symmetric two tensor, in which case I can write it as a one form squared. And if you look at how the Milne boosts act on this thing, they act in this way. N is unchanged under the boost, but this one form shifts by something proportional to N. Now I claim that these warp CFTs are Galilean CFTs with z equals infinity. So time rescales, but space doesn't. Under Weyl. It's really super duper easy once you have this to consider to compute the global symmetries of this thing in flat space. So by flat space, I mean let's take n to be along dx minus, w to be along dx plus. Let's look at reparametrizations, boosts, and that preserve, that fix exactly these guys. Well, if I have any reparametrization of x minus that depends on x plus, then I can't get rid of it with a Weyl transformation, and that'll change n. So the only things I can do, I can have reparametrizations of x minus by x minus, but all of those can be canceled off by a Weyl rescaling. So I get these guys. I can also, well, if I have any x plus that depends on x plus, I can't get rid of that. But if I have an x plus with an additive reparametrization by x minus, I can get rid of it with a Milne boost. That is to say, the global symmetries that fix this background are exactly the ones that I wrote before that characterize a warp CFT. So then it's just pedantic to distinguish the two. Same symmetries, same theories. Once you have that in hand and you're used to this, the kind of manipulating this sort of geometry, you can start writing down more invariant actions, more free field theories for these guys. In particular, you can write down scalar field theories. This is my simplest example. Well, second simplest example. This is a theory of a free real scalar. Free real warp CFT. It has three terms that are allowed. Two terms actually that are allowed. There's a sort of kinetic term. If you rewrote this thing in flat space, it's just d plus phi squared. There's a second term that you can think of as the analog of the conformal coupling to curvature for a relativistic scalar. It's the analog of the psi r phi squared. It's the thing that's needed to soak up the Weyl non-invariance of this term. And it also so happens, so phi scales here with half, with weight 1/2, n rescales, w doesn't, so root gamma scales with weight 1 under Weyl, in which case, actually a quadratic term for phi is also consistent with the Weyl symmetry. That sounds very strange because it looks an awful lot like a mass term, and it is a mass term. How can that be consistent with a scale invariance? Let me just say that what this thing does, that there's no derivative term here that depends on d minus. So what this quadratic term actually does is it exponentially localizes correlations of phi in the x plus direction. And if you construct primary operators that are built out of, you know, phi squared, phi to the 4, et cetera, then what you'll find is that those things have long-range correlations in x minus. And in fact, all the exponential local terms in x plus cancel off. So that thing, despite not looking like a CFT, is a CFT in this sense. If you want to write down a theory with a global symmetry, with a flavor symmetry, you can either do this with multiple scalars, or there's something else that you can do that's even simpler, which is to write down a Lagrangian with a one derivative kinetic term that looks like Weyl fermion with mass term, but just for a complex scalar. I'm not sure yet. I haven't had a chance to check if this thing is related via fermionization to what Hoffman and Rolier write down. My guess is it is, but I don't know. So there's two new theories. It's worth noting that in all three cases, in these two, as well as the example of Diego and Blaise, that the fundamental quantum fields all scale with the same weight under these Weyl. And as a result, it's actually really hard to introduce classically marginal interactions. I'm not even sure I need to think about it harder, if I can introduce classically relevant interactions. It's very weird. One last comment, and then we'll conclude. These theories have some central charges, a Virasoro central charge and a Katz-Muti central charge. those are related to anomalies, just like they are in ordinary 2D CFT, but the structure of the anomalies is rather different than what we are used to. If you will, this teaches you a lesson, unsurprisingly, that non-relativistic anomalies are not the same as relativistic anomalies, which sounds axiomatic, but is a statement that I think is taking a while to penetrate into the condensed matter community. So let me just tell you what the central charges correspond to here. The Katz-Moody central charge doesn't take much work to show that it corresponds to a boost anomaly, the zero derivative boost anomaly. What this means as a matter of practice is that the momentum current in these things, the momentum is just a pure number times k, the Katz-Moody central charge. So there's some momentum in these theories as a result of the anomalies. The Virasoro central charge ends up corresponding to a diff anomaly. This is the usual expression for a diff anomaly. However, the connection that sits in there is a little bit different from the connection that I wrote down before. The connection that appears in the Virasoro anomaly is some tensorial redefinition of gamma. If you want, I can tell you more about it. It took some work to figure out exactly what it was. And I should say that in order for this thing to be Westamino consistent, to satisfy all the things that field theory ought to satisfy, there's accompanying boost and vial non-invariances of the partition function that got to be there that are all fixed by C. Once you have all that, it's kind of straightforward to figure out the anomalous worded entities. It's work in progress. I've been traveling the last couple weeks, so I haven't had a chance to sit down and do it. But then once you have that, then you can, there's lots of things that you can do. You can revisit this question of Cardi. You can even, something that's really extremely basic for these theories, you can ask whether or not there's a good operator state correspondence and moreover a convergent OPE, things that we take for granted in ordinary CFT. All right, if I had more time, I don't, I'd tell you how non-relativistic hydro works. It's a completely different game from what I did, but I don't have time, so let me just say it works. Yeah, story is nice. There'll be a paper out, hopefully, within the week or so. Fairly long paper. Let me summarize. Claim that I've made here today is that Galilean invariant field theories, what they naturally couple to, rather than Riemannian geometry, is this weird thing that's called Newton-Cartan geometry. The crucial ingredient in that construction was a symmetry that ought to be imposed. You can think of it as sort of a local version of Galilean boost invariance, it's Milne boosts. All that tensor data, that geometry, those symmetries, they're realized holographically. And moreover, something a very different community of people care about, these warped conformal field theories in D equals 2, those are actually Galilean CFTs with a Z equals infinity. And I hope I've also impressed on you that there's lots of really fun, simple things to be done here. I hope I'm not the only one to do them. Thank you very much for listening. I think the papers that are doing honest holographic renormalization, formulating an honest holographic dictionary between Schrodinger backgrounds, are either doing this implicitly or explicitly. There's this group with Niels Obers and Hartong and various other, I think Rollier was on these too, actually. They formulate it in terms of Newton-Cartan. So it does help them to do it honestly. So the answer is yes. One would also, actually, just a general comment on holography, that's for Schrodinger spacetimes, but one would hope that there's more holographic duals to non-relativistic field theories out there without it necessarily being Schrodinger. And for that, presumably knowing the right kind of geometry that's realized asymptotically, that's got to help to find other holographic duals. For instance, there's this proposal by Andreas and his former student Stefan Januszewski that certain versions of Hrabowski gravity, to the extent that they're consistent, that those may also give you some holographic duals to non-relativistic theories. And you can ask how all of these symmetries and all that tensor data is realized for those theories of gravity. And maybe there's other corners in the string theory landscape where you can also realize these things.
Not